From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what University of Michigan students encountered when they needed to report sexual abuse by Dr. Robert Anderson.
He runs out of the room, he calls his friend, gets the sense that this was something that the doctor always does, but he didn't report it because it didn't feel, first of all, that he would be believed at all.
We have results of a Michigan Radio investigation. Also, what we don't talk about when we're talking about educating kids at home this fall.
Schools are the number one child care providers in America. That's just the facts. People are able to go to work because their kids go to school. Teachers are able to go to work because their kids go to other teachers' classrooms.
One educator's thoughts about paying parents and more, and what it's like to swim Lake Michigan in 21 hours.
The thing I love about open water swimming, just the immersive, intimate nature of it, to really just be enveloped by nature.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, the man who swam Lake Michigan.
I felt pretty confident that me and my friends could get it done, but none of us had swam in the middle of Lake Michigan before, certainly not in the middle of the night.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, the Detroit News published a story in February about a man named Robert Stone. He'd been a student at the University of Michigan in the 1960s, and he told the news about abuse he'd experienced during medical exams with one of the school's most prominent physicians. Since then, hundreds of others have come forward with similar stories about Dr. Robert Anderson. U of M has tried to distinguish itself from some other big schools where serial sexual predators preyed on students, but some survivors say the university has failed to do things that would move toward accountability and justice. Writer Anna Clark has been looking into this for Michigan Radio, and she joins us now. Hi, Anna.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
We should mention that some of the abuse we're going to discuss will be disturbing. Anna, will you tell us a little bit more about Robert Stone, the man who was in the February article?
Sure. Well, he was in the early 1970s, he was a student at the University of Michigan studying English, theater, and speech. He came from a working class Detroit family. By the time he passed 10th grade, he had gone further in school than either of his parents, and he was getting through school working at a Uniroyal plant over the summers and washing dishes in the Mosher Jordan dorm during the year. But he loved being in Ann Arbor, especially at a time of profound social change. He was also trying to figure out his identity. I mean, he was attracted to both men and women, which was something that felt like was not an option at all at the time. He felt like he had to choose. He felt like being with men would be the best option for him. But of course, this was a time when being gay was literally a crime in the state of Michigan and also considered a mental illness by the psychiatric associations.
Yeah. So a friend recommended Dr. Anderson to him for an exam that he needed, and he went to see Anderson and was sexually abused during the exam in a way that he understood, right?
Right. It was really quite awful. I mean, he wasn't sure the best place to go to see a doctor. A friend recommended Anderson in particular as somebody who would treat gay students without reporting them, would be discreet. So we went to see Dr. Anderson at the University Health Service at U of M's campus, which Anderson was the director of. And when he went into the appointment, it didn't even take very long before Anderson was effectively coercing this young man into masturbating him.
Let's hear a little bit from Robert Stone himself right now.
I was white hot angry that anyone could do this to another human being, especially someone who took an oath of office to first do no harm.
Anna, one of the things that really comes across in the article you wrote is the way that Robert Anderson used the criminalized nature of homosexuality against many of the young men who came to see him. What did you find out about why Robert Stone didn't speak out about what happened?
Right. Well, Robert Stone was very clear that this was not appropriate behavior from a doctor, and he was so upset about it. He runs out of the room. He calls his friend. Gets the sense that this was something that the doctor always does. But he didn't report it because it didn't feel, first of all, that he would be believed at all, that, again, like, gay students in particular were in a very precarious position. They didn't have the same expectations of safety or basic rights that others had. And so he didn't say anything at the time. It's decades later where he got to the point where he felt like it was time to share the story, both with the university and then eventually publicly.
So this bombshell of a story lands in the Detroit News this past February, and that was the first time that we hear publicly of these allegations of abuse against Dr. Anderson, right?
Yes, that's the first time that it became widely known. But this is not the first time the university heard about it. While Robert Stone didn't report it, other students, among the many hundreds of people who have come forward to date that have been harmed by this doctor, several did do what they were supposed to do. They let their coaches know. They let they filed a written complaint. They, complained loudly to the secretary at the UHS. I mean, there were red flags along the way, but none of them taken seriously enough to remove this doctor from campus and from his access to students. The university, it was about 2018 when one of those students who did send up red flags back in the 70s when he was abused, he wrote a letter to the university telling his whole story about what happened to him and the abuse he suffered at the hands of this doctor, not once, but many times at mandated exams to see him as a college athlete.
The name of that student athlete was Tad DeLuca. And he had his reasons for being reticent to come forward. Let's hear a little bit from an interview with DeLuca's attorney, Parker Steinar.
When you're competing against three other teammates for the same spot or the same scholarship, do you want to be the one that rocks the boat? And sadly, these abusers know that and they take advantage of it.
The university quietly began an internal investigation with the campus police to find out more about what was going on. That investigation was turned over to the Washtenaw County Prosecutor's Office, which eventually closed it because Dr. Anderson has been dead for 12 years. And even the few remaining people who directly enabled him are apparently not susceptible to any charges because of various statutes of limitations. And that was kind of it until Robert Stone shared his story with a Detroit news reporter, and suddenly everything kind of breaks open. Then that's when the university apologizes. That's when the university starts setting up a hotline for survivors to call for free and confidential counseling. Things it starts making moves like that.
Anna, you have to wonder how many more students were abused over Robert Anderson's four decades in practice because nobody listened.
Yeah, this is, to a certain extent, we'll probably never know the exact answer. I mean, he was there from the 60s till 2003, and even beyond that, he apparently was still seeing some people. And there are accusations that cross all those decades that all follow the same pattern. While hundreds have come forward in some form now, either publicly sharing their story or anonymously in lawsuits, I heard at least one person say that, like, the number of people who may have been harmed by him could be in the thousands. It was a really systematic predator who had consistent access to not only students and athletes at the University of Michigan, but also pilots, community members, including pilots who were sent to Dr. Anderson for their required physicals from to maintain their pilot's license, and there was people who would seek out Dr. Anderson during the Vietnam era because he was known for doing evaluations that would keep them out of the war. And there was people who saw him for life insurance evaluations. And on top of all the students he had consistent access to, especially once he started working full time with the athletic department, where partly because of his policy changes and his policy influence, athletes were required to see him for annual physicals as in addition to all the other medical care that they were receiving through them. So it was a bit of a machine.
We should take a moment here to note that the University of Michigan is the holder of Michigan Radio's license. Anna Clark, Robert Anderson has been dead a dozen years now, and it turns out a lot of his enablers are gone too. What would you say justice looks like for these survivors today?
That is a question that is still haunts me, honestly. I mean, this is a case where it's not so much about is he or isn't he guilty. The university doesn't even deny it. In fact, the chair of the Board of Regents has acknowledged that he too was abused by this doctor. But now, unlike a case like Larry Nassar at Michigan State, we're not talking about how many years in prison should this guy spend. We're talking about how this happened at the university and what its institutional responsibility is across time. And a lot of that, a lot of what justice looks like is how the university responds right now with being transparent with survivors and making sure that the choices it's making have like put them first rather than the institution's reputation and all that. These are, if it doesn't want to make the same mistakes that a lot of other colleges have. So the university has signaled that it wants to do things a different way. It doesn't want to be as combative, et cetera. Survivors and advocates do have critiques about how this has gone so far. So one of the big ones is that early on, the university hired a law firm to defend itself among these coming lawsuits that was well known for having represented Jeffrey Epstein and Roman Polanski, people who are well known to be sexual abusers. It dismissed that after that became public and hired someone else. It hired a law firm to do an internal investigation about Dr. Anderson on top of the one it did quietly in 2018. That has come up for critique among a lot of survivors and advocates who say that the alternative way to do this would have been to turn things over to the Attorney General's office, have a public entity investigate what happened. Now, the university says this law firm will do a very good job and it'll release the report the same day it receives it. But anyway, the point is that there is a number of ways where survivors and advocates have said that while the university is using a lot of the language of restorative justice and wanting to do things in a different way, the actions feel more combative than they need to be when these are people who, through no fault of their own, were harmed by an institution that should have stopped this doctor's behavior a long time ago.
Investigative journalist Anna Clark. She has written a complete story about Dr. Robert Anderson that you can read right now at michiganradio.org. Anna, thank you for your work on this, and thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you very much.
Up next on the show, the case for paying parents to stay home and take care of kids. That's next after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On August 12th, John Ornay and five of his friends emerged from Lake Michigan on the shores of Ludington.
Walk it up, guys!
They had departed from Wisconsin the day before to swim 54 miles across the lake relay style. And they did it in just under 21 hours. That epic swim is just one of many impressive athletic feats on the Holland native's resume. On top of that, he's also a designer, marketing professional, and musician. And John Ornay joins us now to talk about what he's been doing this summer. John, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, glad to be here.
You were in a pretty serious accident on your bicycle last year. I understand you got hit by an SUV?
That's right. Yep, last May.
Do you mind telling us what happened?
Sure. Yeah, I was riding here in Holland, heading north on Lakeshore Drive, and an SUV was coming the other way and wanted to turn onto Lakewood. And I'm assuming they thought I was just going slower and they had time to kind of sneak in front of me. And instead, they ran right into me, sent me flying about 30 feet and landed on the asphalt. And thankfully, I guess, most of the brunt was taken by my right elbow. My body otherwise was sore, but okay, but kind of hacked off the pointy part of my elbow called the olecranon, which it was kind of floating up in my tricep area. So it needed kind of significant surgery to put that back together.
How did that change how you felt about your body and the things that you wanted to do with it?
Yeah, you know, I've always been pretty grateful for my body and tried hard to take care of it. And treat it like a gift, but something like that, that's kind of a near-death experience, definitely puts everything into perspective, makes you feel grateful for everything you have. And for me personally, really kind of lit a fire under me to not waste this one life. We get one shot at this, and I kind of was pretty committed and inspired to get after the things on my bucket list and not putting things off anymore.
Yeah. Well, what time of the year in 2019 did this happen?
Yes, that was May 16th. So mid-May, I had quite a few goals set for myself that summer that kind of got pushed back, but I was still kind of committed to getting after them. So my July and August goals got pushed to September, but I was still kind of committed to getting the rehab in and getting my body ready to tackle some adventures
so
late summer.
Yeah, it sounds like that really set the tone for the things that you were going to do and the challenges you were going to set for yourself as all of us were physical distancing during COVID. this is not the first time that you've challenged yourself swimming across Lake Michigan. You've done other long distance swims, 100-mile bike rides. What is it that attracts you to these kinds of feats of physical endurance?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. For whatever reason, they appeal to me, and they sound like both like fun in an odd way, but also, generally speaking, in life, I'm really attracted to the question, I wonder what would happen if. So especially this Lake Michigan challenge this year, it was just a huge unknown. I felt pretty confident that me and my friends could get it done, but none of us had swam in the middle of Lake Michigan before, certainly not in the middle of the night. Obviously, it's unpredictable. Weather's unpredictable. So yeah, mostly just a curiosity, wondering what my body's capable of and what I'm going to learn along the way.
Why did you decide to do it in the middle of the night?
Yeah, well, we had to. We figured it would take us 24 hours or more. We actually ended up doing it in under 21 hours, but can't really find a 21-hour chunk without darkness. So it was just a strategy of whether we're going to get the night portion out on the front end or the back end, but we kind of let weather determine that window for us.
Was there a reason why you chose Lake Michigan to do this as opposed to someplace else?
Sure. Yeah. So I live in Holland right here on the shores of Lake Michigan, and all the other five swimmers are also from Holland, Zealand here. You know, growing up, we've been able to play in and marvel at kind of what we call our freshwater ocean here. And it's a pretty magnificent body of water. It's cool. You know, our whole lives we've been looking out from this side of the lake at the horizon into the unknown. And we've been on the other side in Wisconsin as well, but there's still a lot of unknown, at least us, certainly as swimmers, territory in between. So to kind of journey together was pretty special.
How do you build up your endurance for a swim like that?
A lot of swimming. Yeah, so it was a little bit of a strange year because, you know, pools have been shut down since February or so. So really, as soon as the temperature in my little 18-acre pond here in my neighborhood, we have a 18-acre lake, which is about a third of a mile across, about 3/4 of a mile if you swim around the perimeter. So as soon as that got into the mid-40s, we were out there swimming. One of my first swims, it was 33 degrees outside, air temperature.
Oh,
yeah. But it was, that's Michigan. We kind of had the goal to swim across the lake and couldn't really wait till the water and air were warm to start training. So we kind of got after it. But yeah, mostly long-ish swims several times a week. So I generally swim 4 to 5 times a week and usually only 1 to 3 miles at a time. Then similar to running, just kind of tagging on long swims on the weekends and building up mileage.
Right. John, I noticed that earlier in the year, you wrote on your website, and this was written before the pandemic hit, you wrote that 2020 is shaping up to be an awesome year. I have my eyes set on a handful of new records and a lot of other adventures along the way. Needless to say, the tone of the year has changed substantially since then. And you had other goals this year, including setting a world record for cycling 100 miles and trying to set a world record for summiting Mount Everest. Do you think you're going to get to those other two goals in 2020?
I'm not sure. So the summiting Mount Everest thing is actually, it's a goal called Everesting. It's climbing the cumulative elevation of Everest. So I actually wasn't planning to climb the mountain itself. I was hoping to do that in Michigan.
Climbing the equivalent of Mount Everest. I see.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yep. So it's a challenge that, you know, pick a 100-foot hill and do it 291 times and you've Everested. But yes, I'm still hoping to do both of those things, but yeah, the circumstances we find ourselves in are pretty unprecedented and hard to figure out and plan. So I still don't know, because there's other lives and venues that I need access to do those things.
Do you still feel like you want to do those things?
I do. 2020 has definitely changed our plans and goals. So I'm not dead set on, no matter what, I'm gonna move heaven and earth to do those things, but if I'm gonna do everything I can to try. But life has changed, so goals change. You know, my kids, I'm gonna be homeschooling my kids this fall. which is super exciting. We're calling it Epic Adventure School, and we're doing it with three other families. We're doing kind of a co-op homeschool model. And so that's gonna take a ton of time and effort and energy. And I'm excited about that. So yeah, new goals are presenting themselves. I'm doing my best. My family's doing our best to reevaluate life and say, okay, given this new information, now what's most important? And this is, you know, this fall in particular is a pretty cool moment to try some new things with our 8 and 10 year old kids. So that's definitely a new commitment and goal.
What kind of goals do you help them set for themselves in terms of challenges?
Yeah. So for me personally, I've always let curiosity be my guide. And that's really my model with my kids too. Like, what are you interested in? What do you want to do? What do you want to explore? What do you want to try? Definitely I'm not at all pushing my kids to try crazy physical feats. Certainly. They a little bit get a kick out of the things I do, but I'm just their dad. They're interested in their own world. My daughter's getting into horseback riding with her grandma, which is awesome. My son is a huge reader and likes just his individual projects. He's been getting into making iMovies with friends in the neighborhood. So just pursuing their curiosity and using my experience to kind of help them where they need it, but really letting them mostly be self-led and inspired.
A lot of your challenges aren't just things that you've done yourself, although some of them are. In a number of cases, you've been working with other people to break records. What's different about that?
Oh, it's just more fun. Especially that's what really made this swim this year extra special, you know, at a time when, you know, doing things in community and socializing in any way is really at a minimum. It was pretty special to have five other guys that I was seeing on a regular basis. You know, we were open water swimming is a pretty socially distant, safe endeavor for the most part. You know, we'd meet on the beach and chat a bit and go for a swim. And then, you know, having a like-minded goal and working hard toward it is always helps motivation and makes it more fun. So super special to do it with others, makes it more fun and interactive. And then too, it's something you share together forever instead of, you know, crossing a finish line by yourself and knowing how that feels. It's pretty cool to be able to share that joy with others.
Could you take us back to when you did the Lake Michigan swim and just tell us what it was like, this experience of being out in the open water in the middle of night on the lake. What was going through your mind?
Just trying my best to soak it all in. It was just really special. We did some practice swims in the dark, so we weren't, it wasn't totally new. We were pretty well prepared. I think most people, when you think about it, think how terrifying that would that experience could be. Mm-hmm. But by the time we really did the swim, we were pretty comfortable. So then it was just, you know, there was a meteor shower going on that night. It was a clear sky, so there's not a better time to look up at the sky than a clear night in the middle of the lake with no city lights to be seen. It was just remarkable and really special. Just really trying to soak it all up. It was interesting. It was actually a pretty wavy night. We had 2 to 4 foot waves for about 4 hours in the middle of the night. So just feeling your body getting rocked mm-hmm. in the water. But the thing I love about open water swimming, and it was heightened in this swim and in the middle of the night for sure, is just the immersive kind of intimate nature of it, to really just be enveloped by nature and the lake in particular, who I kind of think about and refer to as I swim as my grandmother. It's a pretty special experience, and the night swimming was certainly something we'll never forget.
John Ornay lives in Holland. John, thank you so much for telling us about everything you've been doing this summer, and good luck with the rest of those challenges.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Wheels are grinding on the return to school for this fall. You know, we keep saying return to school as if most of the schools in Michigan weren't doing at least hybrid restarts with online options for this pandemic-informed academic year. Tomorrow night, I'll be hosting a live Issues in Ale event for Michigan Radio via Zoom, in which we'll dig deeper into safety and education issues. It's called Keep Calm and Teach On. And our guests will include Stateside's education commentator, Matenga Ragatz, and Jametta Lilly of the Detroit Parent Alliance. Information's at michiganradio.org right now. Meanwhile, many educators' attention is focused on the families they serve who are lacking options for childcare, technology, tutoring, all the assets that will be needed to make distance learning really work this year. Shayla Griffin is co-founder and facilitator for Justice Leaders Collaborative, a consultancy based in Dexter that helps educators with equity work. She's written a number of essays recently that caught our eye about how we can approach reopening in a way that keeps everyone safe while giving the state's most vulnerable students and families the support that they need. Shayla Griffin, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You wrote in one of your recent articles that many people who are arguing for in-person instruction are saying that schools who serve our most vulnerable students have to be able to provide things like meals and special education services. But at the same time, Black communities and Latinx communities and other communities of color are facing this increased risk of COVID complications. How do you start to think about the balance on those concerns?
Well, I think what we have is really kind of a perfect storm of inequality and injustice. We have both a medical crisis that obviously disproportionately targets communities of color and low-income communities, and that's COVID. And we have an academic crisis that disproportionately targets those exact same communities, right? And that's about schools being closed. And so I think the first thing I think, and as I wrote in my essay, is that I think we really have to wrestle with what I call the both and of that. We have to wrestle with the reality that there are two very real, very critical crises that the same communities are facing on both sides. And so then I think once we accept that, the question is, what's kind of the best option of a lot of kind of really bad options? And so what I have proposed is that we should start with safety and thinking about what really can schools do in terms of where they're located, in terms of community spread in their area. Is it actually even safe enough to open anything for anyone? Is there access to testing? Can we do masks? Can we do spacing? Can we do cleaning? So what is school's capacity? And so I think schools should first start there. Like, how many people can we really serve? Mm-hmm. How do we get educator buy-in in that? Because I think you have to have the people that are going to be doing the work on board. And if you kind of are making plans without them at the table, you know, there's a huge teacher shortage right now, and I think it's only going to get significantly worse.
Well, I was going to ask if you think schools are in a position to take this from a perspective of how many people can we really serve and do the job that we need to do for them. It's a very tight financial year, regardless of what may happen with state and federal intervention.
I think they have to. I mean, what's the other option, right? I mean, and then once they identify how many students that is, then you have to say, who do we most need to serve? And that need might be based on income and housing insecurity, food insecurity. It might be based on special education needs and students with disabilities and making sure their needs are met. It might be based on mental health needs of families or students. I think it should be based on age, which is that, you know, a junior in high school can theoretically really do online learning and a kindergartner really cannot, right? Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of dimensions around which I think schools should be considering who their highest priority is in terms of face-to-face education. And I think they should be doing that.
My guest today is Shayla Griffin. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation about making this very strange school year work for the state's most vulnerable students. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue our conversation now with Shayla Griffin of Justice Leaders Collaborative. She's been thinking through the start of school this fall and its consequences for kids, teachers, and parents. Shayla, the teachers that you work with, what kinds of things are they telling you about the families that they worry about or the situations that they're sort of most concerned about having to deal with this fall?
Oh, all the teachers I work with are highly stressed about every part of it. So many of them are very, very worried about their most marginalized kids, just a lot of them are worried about, like, will kids eat? You know, just basic things. Will young kids be supervised? You know, will they be able to do any kind of academic kind of things if it's all virtual? And at the same time, those teachers are really, really, really worried about their own health, their own families. A lot of the teachers I work with have their own children. And so they're trying to figure out how to do their job and raise their kids and support their kids' education. A lot of teachers I work with have children who go to school in different districts than the districts they teach in. So then they're potentially have kids in a school district that's doing online only, but they're being asked to do face-to-face and there's no childcare stopgap there. And so I think it's kind of this whirlwind of educators' love for their job and love for their students and genuine concern and commitment to supporting them and their love for themselves and their own children, their own families. And a lot of them see, I think, no good way out. And I would also say a lot of them are feeling very much like they are not being invited to the table to engage in these conversations, this decision-making. They're just kind of being told what they're going to do. And so they have no more kind of knowledge or understanding about what's going on than I do or than you do. You know, they're reading about plans in the newspaper. And so I think they're very stressed and feeling very devalued, which is unfortunate because, of course, they're so valuable.
And they're the ones who are going to make this work one way or the other.
And they did. You know, I mean, we shut down schools in March across the state. And within days, a lot of teachers transformed what they were doing from an in-person model to an online model very quickly. And I think now we've had some months to try to figure out what this is going to look like. And instead of saying, let's invite those experts to the table who did this, who transformed their practice, you know, in a week's time, they're kind of being left out of the conversation. So there's a lot of frustration there, I think, among teachers.
You wrote another essay that got an awful lot of likes from parents, making a modest proposal that we pay parents to stay home with their kids. What got you thinking about that?
Funnily, the paying parents to stay home with their kids is something I originally thought about in March. Like, that was my original idea. And I thought it sounded so radical.
at the front end of the pandemic, before things got really, really real.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm not a person that lives really in denial a lot. And so it was very real to me, you know, by the end of March that this pandemic was real, that there wasn't going to be a vaccine coming anytime soon, that we had an administration that wasn't probably going to take it seriously. And so by the fall, we were still going to have a situation where we were going to be needing to rethink education. Like, that was very clear to me pretty quickly. And as a parent myself, I just kept thinking, okay, how do you do this thing where there's no school, And, you know, schools are the number one child care providers in America. That's just the facts. People are able to go to work because their kids go to school. Teachers are able to go to work because their kids go to other teachers' classrooms. And so how are we going to raise children who are school aged with no schooling, no child care, or much limited schooling and child care, and have parents work their jobs? And what I also know to be true is that that's not possible to do. You can't work a full-time job in your house or out of your house and raise your children 24 hours, 7 days a week. And so I thought, really what we have to do is like accept this moment, accept this crisis, accept that the people that are the healthiest option for children are the people they already live with to stay home and take care of them so COVID doesn't spread, so they can do their academics, so that they can be cared for. And in order for parents to be able to do that, who have traditionally worked outside of the home and need to do that, we have to give them money, because what are they going to live on? And so you can't say as a society, we're not going to provide any place for children to be, and we're not going to provide families with anything to take care of themselves. Go figure it out. That's an impossible conundrum. And it's especially impossible, again, for the most marginalized families who are already, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, or I think the average American has only $400 in their savings account. That's not a sustainable system. And so I think that if we were a smart government and we were really committed to the well-being of children and the well-being of families, we would just say, this is a year where we're going to have to give folks money so that they can do the job that schools have traditionally done, which is supervise and care for children during the day.
We've been living for so long with the myth of families that take care of their own children and their own children exclusively, and that the idea of being paid to stay home with children would be somehow a socialist idea. You know, it does kind of fly in the face of the intergenerational families that have been the bedrock of America for so long. But just beyond that, and taking this on the political face of it, what do you think it would take to get people to buy into the approach?
So interestingly, there's already been a little bit of buy-in about this, because when the pandemic first hit and they passed the $600 per week for folks who applied for and got unemployment, that $600 additional dollars that Congress passed, that was kind of a similar idea. It wasn't based on who had children, but it was the assumption that if, because of this pandemic, you are no longer able to work because of something outside of your control, as a government, we should be providing you something to live on, not only because it's a moral and kind of human injustice responsibility, but also because it's good for the economy, which is like, if people have no money, they can't spend money. And so I think that what I've proposed is actually not so far from what there was already buy-in about, which is if people are staying home and they aren't working either because there are no schools or because there are no jobs or because we've asked them to stay home so as to not spread this disease, then we have to give them something to live on. And so I would suggest that this is just taking that idea that I think already has a lot of buy-in and trying to think about how it specifically works for families with school-aged children. Of course, you know, I mean, the Republican Party isn't interested in doing that, nor is the President of the United States so much. So it is a polarized issue because our country is a really polarized country. But I think fundamentally it's a human issue, and a human issue that the majority of Americans and the majority of our leaders really, really think is essential.
For that matter, I think it's unclear whether the Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden, is ready to go there. I know some members of Congress have spoken out about this, but he has not taken a stance on it so far. Shayla, you do a lot of equity work with teachers and other folks in the education system. And we're in a moment where we've seen a lot of white Americans speak out about issues of racial injustice. How should that activism translate to what's happening right now in schools?
Well, you know, I think the hardest thing about equity and justice is they're hard to talk about, but they're easier to talk about than to take action on. That's just the truth. And so I think we're in a moment right now where a lot of people who have not historically been kind of thinking about these issues and activists in this realm are starting to kind of wake up to the realities of injustice in our country and are trying to take a stand. And the struggle that I think COVID presents and just our society presents is that taking a stand is not just about the words you say and the things you post on the internet, but also about the specific decisions you make for your own life and for your own children. And making those decisions that are most aligned with justice, I think, is really a hard thing for a lot of people. And we're seeing that manifest in our schools. And so, for example, I think a lot of the school reopening conversation is being motivated by the desires of the most privileged families who, in the way that I think about this, would not be people who we are prioritizing for face-to-face education, because they're not the people with the most need, but it's those families that are speaking up and that are being vocal and that are, in some cases, pressuring districts to open when it may or may not be safe to do so because they want their kid in school. And that's not about justice. There's other conversations about pandemic pods that have gotten a lot of attention that I've weighed in on a little bit that really is about how do you take action for justice while also taking care of your own child. And I think that a lot of families are in a position right now of struggling to figure out how to do that.
Do you think pods can work outside of the bubble of white middle-class families right now?
I mean, I think it depends on what you mean by pods. I think everyone who has children is having to figure out what to do with their children. If you have children right now and there is no schooling, there is no, you know, if your daycares are not open and you have to go to work, you're not going to leave them alone. I mean, you can't leave a six-year-old home alone. Mm-hmm. And so any parent right now is having to figure out a place for their children. And, you know, what we're calling a pod versus what we're calling like getting your friend to watch your kid, you know, we could have some discussion about. But I think ideally, if we're thinking about equity and justice, I would like to see some of our organizations, our schools, be really thinking about how to use the connections they have, the resources they have to help connect parents in ways that are not just about the people they already are in relationship with. I think so long as individual families are making individual plans for their individual kids, pods are going to be segregated by race and class. Like there's no way for them not to be because that's who people are in relationship with. And so for them to not be segregated by race and class, it's going to take a systems response. And I think school systems are uniquely positioned to try to be a part of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Shayla Griffin. She is the co-founder of Justice Leaders Collaborative. She's talking to us today from her home in Detroit. Shayla, thinking about it that way, that's a really interesting and complex question. If pods can be of use to people who are not in a position to use them to leave public schools and maybe hire their own teachers to get through the pandemic, that would imply that kids can be matched up with others who maybe live near them. Yes, I'm just sort of thinking out loud here. But
yeah,
like,
I mean, so, you know, what I've tried to clarify a little bit is that we're kind of using this term pods to talk about a couple different things.
Right.
So one thing that you were talking about is just what I call just a child care collective, which is who's going to be the adult in charge of watching children. There is another kind of pods, which are kind of what I would call mini private schools, where a group of parents who have money and privilege and wealth are going to come together and basically hire a teacher or a tutor to basically educate their child. And I would say those are very different things. I think everyone has to find the child care collective. Not everyone, but everyone has to find child care, right? Mm-hmm. It's only privileged people who are thinking about opting out of a public school system and hiring their own teacher. And that is the part that I would say is unjust. So it is not unjust to figure out where your kid is going to be during the day. It is unjust to say, because I have the money to do so and the connections to do so and lots of other friends with the money to do so, let's forget that public education thing I was doing. Let's just make a private school for ourselves. Because that undermines the public education system. It gives your already privileged child access to resources that other kids are not going to get. I've talked a little bit in some articles I've written about, you know, are parents even justly paying and compensating these teachers they're thinking about hiring? Are they socially just and equitable employers? Are they giving them paid leave? Are they giving them health insurance? And so there's lots of ways that I think the mini private school thing is really a problem. And what I have really recommended is that people are going to try to find a child care collective, a pod, to take on the responsibility of supervising children. They should do so in a way that still accesses the virtual online learning that their public school is offering. And so, yes, I think if all families were doing that, the ones that are doing it independently and maybe some families that are forming these collectives through maybe support of their schools or communities, then you don't have the education injustice there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that this is happening anywhere, really.
These issues are not theoretical concerns for you. You are a mom and you've got young kids at home. Do you mind telling us a bit about what the past 5 months have been like for you?
I think I use the term hot mess a lot when I describe what it's been. So I have a five-year-old who is deaf, and the way special education works in the state, that means he's had access to public school since he was two. And so this is actually our fourth year going into the public school system with him, even though he's technically only going into kindergarten this year. And then I have a three-year-old and a two-year-old. And so far what we have done is just I'm married, which is a real privilege. And both my spouse and I have just basically worked slightly less and just tag team, like either you're working or on your own or your own kids. I mean, I think there's no model that I propose in which I would get a face-to-face slot. my kids are too privileged. They just don't, they would. And we're a family for whom a lot of the pod conversation doesn't work either, which is that, you know, one of the things that's funny about those conversations is it seems to assume everyone has one child and, and the child is like school aged or something. So I don't know a pod that even if I could figure something out for my 5-year-old, am I going to say, and by the way, could you take my 2- and 3-year-old? Oh. My oldest son is deaf. And so if you don't know sign language, we're out of the loop, right? And so this is another concern about pods, which is it works for small families with school-aged children who don't have any disabilities or any particular needs for accommodation. But if you have any special thing or any larger family, it's not a real option. And so for our family, it's not been a real option. And we've kind of just accepted that we're going to just have to continue doing what we're doing, which is trying to raise kids while trying to do, you know, interviews.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
As you've thought about these issues on a macro level, do you think that there are any guiding principles that, you know, that there hasn't been a ton of government leadership about how this should work? You know, the state's focus has been on making sure local districts can play to their own strengths and do what they do best, which is great in some ways, but also leaves districts responsible for an awful lot of different issues. Do you think that there are any guiding principles that can help schools and other local leaders to try to ensure that as many kids as possible can get their academic and emotional needs met?
Start first with justice and equity. I don't know that people are starting at that first. And to start first with justice and equity means your responses and your decisions are not about the parents who are calling you. Like that should have no bearing. Your responses and your decisions are about the students and families who you serve, who have the most need, however that's defined in your local place. And so if you start with, these are the students we know will not be okay along a lot of dimensions if they cannot have some kind of access to this institution in a face-to-face capacity, then everything you're doing is centered around that. But I think a lot of people are not starting there. They're instead kind of feeling pressured by, you know, the loudest voices in the room, and the loudest voices in the room are often the most privileged voices in the room. The other thing I would say is you have to start with the science. And so one of the things that's actually very concerning about the conversation about reopening schools is there is very little consideration in consulting with like epidemiologists, public health officials, doctors. And I will be honest, I have a lot of respect for educators, but this is not their area of expertise. If you have a master's degree, a PhD, a bachelor's degree in education at any level, you do not have a medical background. You do not have a public health background. You do not have a background that helps you understand how disease spreads. And so we're asking school leaders to make decisions about what they're going to do. And honestly, school boards as well, right? Assuming that they have all the information to make those decisions. And unless they have taken it upon themselves to bring to the table the epidemiologists, the public health officials, they are not necessarily making those decisions with any more information than you or I have. They know exactly what we know, which is like whatever we read in the newspaper. And so, you know, the other thing that I think really has to happen for justice, especially because we know students and families of color and low-income students or families are actually most at risk for dying of COVID-19, is that we have to have real conversations with medical professionals who are sitting at the table, helping us think through and make these decisions, and even making some of the decisions, because we have to recognize there's nothing in our training as educators that prepared us to do this. And my worry is that there's a lot of leaders who are just making decisions based on kind of like their interpretation of, I don't know, what they think about the data, and people are going to get really sick and die who didn't have to.
Shayla Griffin with Justice Leaders Collaborative. She's been coming to us from her home in Detroit today. Shayla, in the year of doing too much, thank you so much for giving a little time to us.
Thank you.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. Or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. That's Stateside for today. The show is produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren with help from our interns, Nell Ovid, Olive Scott, and Catherine Newhan. The show is directed by Mercedes Mejia, and our executive producer is Hurricane Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for being here. We'll see you Wednesday.